Tonight I'd like to offer some reflections on dealing with conflict in our social relationships. And this arose for me because someone was telling me the other day about an unpleasant experience that they'd had with a salesperson. And in the course of trying to buy something, this person had gotten into an argument with the salesperson and had ended up in tears. And when they were telling me the story, they said that these days you need a survival kit to be out there in this hostile world. And what's a Buddhist survival kit? And so I started to reflect on what that would include. And most of you are probably familiar with the fact that there is a lot of conflict out there in the world these days. But unfortunately, very often, the conflict that we're most aware of is the conflict between ourselves and the people that we're closest to, the people who are our partners or our children or our parents, the people we work with, the people we live next door to. And some years ago, this situation was described as having intimate enemies. And that's maybe something that all of us can understand, that the people who are closest to us are the ones who have the most impact on us and the potential to engage us in the most severe conflict that we experience. And so I'd like to talk about the Buddha's way of dealing with conflict in our relationships. But like so much of the Buddha's teaching, it doesn't offer a quick fix solution. It's not a matter of just having the one answer that's going to solve our problems. So I ask for your indulgence to be patient as I go through the step-by-step outline of the Buddha's teaching on dealing with conflict. And the first aspect that we need to be aware of is that the Buddha talks not only about what we have to do, but understanding the context in which conflict arises. And the words that this person used when they were asking for some advice are very telling. What's a survival kit? You need a survival kit. And the first thing that we need to understand when we're thinking about relationships and why we get into conflict and why we need a survival kit is because we all want to survive. And that seems obvious, but unless we actually recognise that as the starting point, we wonder why other people are always making our lives so difficult. Each one of us wants to survive. According to the Buddha's teaching, we are propelled from one birth to the next by our craving and also our ignorance. And our craving comes in three ways, three aspects of the same thing, in Pali called bhava tanha, the desire to be, karma tanha, the desire to have things the way we want them to be, conditions and people, ourselves included, and vibhava tanha, which is the desire to get rid of those things in our environment, in the people around us, and in ourselves that we don't like, the things that make life difficult. And I'd like to give an analogy of how this works. The bhava tanha is what brings us back over and over again. It's our will to live. This is the fuel, but the fuel to be here. And I'd like to just give a little story to illustrate this. Just imagine that you're getting ready to go to work in the morning and you come out into the garage and the car just won't start. Whatever you do, you just can't get it going, and you call the RAC and no one comes, and it's obvious that this vehicle is not going to take you to work today and time is running out. And so you make the decision that you'll leave that car and you'll hop on the bus, the next bus that's coming, which you know if you can just catch that bus, you'll make it to work in time. But you have to race. So you leave the car and you race off to catch the bus. And as you're racing to the bus stop, you see that the bus is just pulling out. So you have to run very, very fast. But fortunately, there's a very nice driver on the bus and he stops and he just make it in time to get on. You're very pleased to just get on the bus, to have made it there. And it takes you a while to catch your breath because you've had all that fuss and bother with the car and worrying about whether you're going to make it to work in time or not. So for a while, you're just happy to stand there and catch your breath and be happy that you've made it. But after a while, you've caught your breath and you think, oh, now I'm here, might as well sit down. Where is there a seat? And you look around and you see the bus is full, except for the seat right down the front. And just as you think, well, I'll go and get that seat, the driver stops for someone else and they get in and they take the seat. Now, before, the driver was a great pal because he stopped for you. But now he stopped for someone else and they've taken the last seat. So that causes a bit of irritation. Why did he have to stop for them? And then you see that the person who's gotten on is your neighbour that you're not on good terms with. And so they've got the last seat, but there is still one next to them. So now you have to decide whether you really want to sit down and have your neighbour ask you, well, what's happened with your car? And you have to explain all your business to them and go into all that rigmarole. Or will you stand up and just be grateful that you've got the ride to work? And while you're deciding what you're going to do, you think, well, let's see, maybe there's some other seat. And you look around and you see that the bus is full of all these school kids who have taken up all the seats that adults should be sitting in, and you're an adult. And so immediately you start to get annoyed with all these kids who are on the bus. What are they doing on the bus? Why are they taking up all the seats? Why don't they stand up and give me the seat that I should have? Now, every other morning you drive to work, you don't know who's on the bus and you don't care. But today it matters because that's the way you're travelling. And this is like our life. Having to leave behind the car that doesn't work is like leaving behind the body of the previous birth. We leave that one behind, it just can't we can't get it going any longer. And so we have to drop it. And we have to catch the bus, which is our next birth. This is a very crude analogy, but something like what happens. And first of all, the bhava tanha just propels us to make the effort to get onto the bus. And we're so pleased that we just made it. We don't even care how slowly it travels or what happens, as long as we're on it. Then after we've recovered a little bit, then we want to have a seat. We want to have things comfortable. We want them a little bit better than just standing up and being on the bus. And that's when we start to come into conflict. Sometimes we can get what we want, but it's at a price. Maybe we have to sit next to our neighbour and tell them our stories or listen to their stories. And maybe it's worth it. And that's kama tanha, trying to have things as comfortable as possible, weighing up whether standing is better than listening or listening is worth it to get a seat. And then looking around and seeing, well, look at all these other people who are taking up seats that I could have. And before, they weren't even part of our world. But now they've come in conflict with us because they've got what we want, or they're not giving us what we want. And so they become part of our universe, if you like, our mental universe as well as our physical world. And this is what happens in our daily life. Each one of us thinks that our journey is the most important. And we come in conflict with each other because that's the way it is. Each one of us thinks that way. And so in a situation like this, and in our daily life situations, the very least thing that we do when we are engaging in social contact is that we make wrong anyone who doesn't serve us. Doesn't matter who they are or what they're doing, once they don't serve us, somehow they're wrong. That's the starting point. The extreme of that is thinking that someone is such an obstacle to our own well-being that we're prepared to kill them. Or that we can never get things the way we want them to be. We kill ourselves, suicide. That's the vibhava tanha. So between the extremes of making wrong those who don't serve us and killing, all the spots in between, the way we struggle and juggle with our life to try to make sure that our ride on the bus is as comfortable as possible. We don't really want to get off the bus unless we absolutely have no choice, and ultimately we don't. All of us are going to have to get off the bus sometime. But while we're on it, we're going to hang on for dear life. And this is tanha. This is craving. And we all have it. And we're all in the same boat. And this is the starting point for understanding the conflicts that we experience in our daily life. Having said that, when we understand how important it is for each one of us to survive, the Buddha's teaching takes quite a U-turn, the next step, because it points out that survival at any price is also not what we're aiming for. To win at the expense of others, to win through hurting others, harming others, is also not skillful, not the way to go. So even though we want to survive, the Buddha's teaching is that we have to understand that if we think that our survival is the most important thing and we do it at the expense of other people, that we are only planting seeds for our own suffering now and in the future. And this, you can understand, is quite the opposite to the way of the world. The way of the world, which recognises I'm the most important, number one. I've got to look after myself at any cost. And the Buddha's teaching says no. Because if we do that, if we act out of hatred, if we act out of greed, if we act in selfish ways, that very action is going to cause suffering for ourselves. We can't act with aversion, with ill will, with hatred, without generating tremendous negativity in our own mind. And the experience of the presence of that negativity is actually very unpleasant. So even if we win through what we do, we're going to have an unpleasant experience. And if we act with self-centeredness in this way, this is the kind of karmic seed that we're planting. And a seed of ill will, a seed of hatred, a seed of avarice, of envy, jealousy, can only fruit in unwholesomeness for ourselves in this life or in future lives. This is the law of cause and effect. For those of you who aren't familiar with this law, it says that in nature, the law is that if you plant a mango seed, you'll get a mango fruit, no matter how much you try to change it once it's planted. It's the same in the law in the area of morality, of relationships. If you plant a seed of harmfulness, then you will reap a fruit of harm to yourself in the future. And so survival at any cost is also not the Buddhist way. And the other understanding of life which supports this kind of practice is the understanding that very often we think that if I can just win this time, in this battle, in this relationship, at this conflict, that I'm going to be set up for the rest of my life, that things are going to be great from now on, if I can just win this time. And the Buddha's teaching invites us to reflect on the fact that life is a process and it's constantly changing. And so even if we win this time, it's not an ultimate victory. because we have to face the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And there's no guarantee how our life is going to change after this. This particular victory isn't going to bring us unending happiness. It isn't going to be the thing that's going to set us up for life. And so that puts it in perspective. It puts winning at any cost in perspective, seeing that, in fact, it's not possible, even if we get the best settlement out of this dispute, even if we win over this person this time, it's not going to be the end of our troubles in life. So to reflect on this, to help us to put this battle that we're fighting right now in some kind of perspective in terms of the whole of our life. So you see, the Buddha's way of approaching dealing with conflict is quite contrary to the way of the world. And so it's important for us to come back to our own experience of what it's like when the mind is full of anger, full of ill will, full of greed, full of jealousy. Because the next step is to understand, but from our own experience, that the mind that is defiled by these kind of unwholesome qualities is a very unhappy mind. It's a very unpleasant way of living our life. And when the mind is free of hatred, free of avarice, free of jealousy, it's a very happy, bright mind, and it's a pleasant way to live one's life. So the encouragement to let go of unwholesomeness and to cultivate wholesomeness in our life has to come from our own experience of what it means to have a mind that's free of defilements. When we have a mind that has defilements in it, then we can experience for ourselves the unpleasantness of it. When anger arises, there's an immediate physical change in our body in reaction to the stress that the body comes under. The heart rate quickens, the blood pressure goes up, we feel heat. And as a result of that, we very often experience it's impossible to think straight when we're full of anger. When this kind of reaction is taking place in the body, it affects the mind, the clarity of the mind. It also affects the way we look. When we're angry, we look terrible, we look ugly. The Buddha said we should cultivate, we should contemplate this, what we look like when we're in the middle of a rage, when we're in the middle of a temper. And especially if we spend lots of our time in an angry mood, in the middle of a temper, then our physical body is going to be continually under stress, our mind is going to be continually cloudy, fuzzy, and the expression on our face is going to become very set as an angry face. And if you know people who are perpetually angry or upset with life, you know that they're very agitated, that there's very little peacefulness about them. And their experience of this state is an experience of extreme discomfort. But unless we start to reflect on this, we blame it on someone else. Someone else is causing us all of this discomfort. So the first step is to experience for ourselves what it feels like when the mind is defiled, and to think about whether it's for our own well-being or not. Forget about the other person. What's it doing to me? The Buddha said that when we are continually in allowing our mind to dwell in unwholesomeness, that it's like weaving a cloth. Thread by thread, those unwholesome states build up in the mind until they become like a cloth that is defiled or discoloured with patches on it, patches of dirt, patches of stain. If we want to put that cloth into some dye and change its colour, make it look more beautiful, it's very difficult to get a good result because the cloth that has the stains on it won't be able to take up the dye that it's that is in the dye bath. The result we'll get is very patchy. And this is like the mind, which is continually weaving its experience of life based on negativity. Eventually, it becomes very difficult to experience anything pleasant or good in life because we're always seeing it through a cloud of unwholesomeness, of negativity. And so even when we come in contact with things which are nice, people who are nice, it's very difficult to appreciate them. And it's also very difficult when we start to train the mind, coming to listen to Dharma talks like this, trying to understand the Buddha's teachings, trying to meditate. We find that it's very difficult to experience the goodness, the happiness, the positiveness of it, because our mind is like that piece of cloth which is stained and soiled. It can't take up the dye which is being offered. And so when we understand that this is for our own harm, if we allow this state of affairs to continue, then we'll be prepared to make the effort to do something about changing the state of our own mind. And the Buddha gave another simile. He said that when we just get angry from time to time and it arises and passes away, that's like drawing a line on water. The line is drawn on water, but immediately it passes away and you can't see the effect. When we get angry more often than that, say we know that mornings are a bad time for us, we're in a grumpy mood, whatever happens in the morning before breakfast, we're going to be irritated by it, then that's like drawing a line on the sand. The line is there until the tide washes it away. It's not permanent, but it still has an impact. And if we just dwell in negativity, if we allow our mind to always be full of either dislike or wanting, unhappy at the things we don't have, unhappy with the things that we have in our life, then the Buddha said this is like drawing a line on rock, not just drawing it on, but carving it in. And that line on the rock is very difficult then to erase. It takes a lot of work, a lot of effort to be able to change that habitual way of responding to life from unwholesome to wholesome. But this is what we need to do wherever we're at if we want to experience the happiness and peacefulness of the undefiled mind. And you notice again that talking about the Buddhist approach to dealing with conflict, we're still on ourselves. We haven't worked yet even with the issue or the other person. We're still looking at our own state of mind, coming back to being aware of our own experience of the unwholesome and being aware of how it feels when that's present, not looking out to who's making it unpleasant, but looking at our own experience and understanding this is where we have some control, this is where we have the power to make some changes in our own state of mind. So when we come to practice, we need to understand that the first step is to be able to recognize when unwholesome states are present, to acknowledge them. Not to acknowledge them with dislike or self-hatred, but just to be able to acknowledge them and recognize that they're unskillful, they don't serve us well. So mindfulness, the ability to observe our own states of mind, observe our own behaviors, and understand what it means for us, clear comprehension, this is a very important first step in being able to deal with conflict that arises in our own life. Once we become skilled at knowing that these unwholesome states are present, then we're in the position of being able to tackle them, to do something about them. When we're still looking outside at the issue, at the person, at the other people who are on the bus with us and blaming them for what's happening in our own life, then we're missing the point. We have to keep coming back to ourselves. Now, one of the things which draws us out so much to looking for happiness through other people, satisfaction in what we can get from the world, is that we have this misunderstanding that our true happiness can be found in the things of the world, can be found in other people. And so the next step is to understand the limitations of what we can gain from the world outside ourselves. Yes, we can experience pleasure, we can experience temporary happiness, but we're never going to find lasting satisfaction there. But while ever we put all of our effort on making the world suit us and people be the way we want them to be, then we're always going to be very dependent, very vulnerable on the experiences that we have with things outside ourselves. We need to become independent of the world by understanding the limitations of what the world can offer us, and then being able to cultivate the inner pleasure, the inner peace that is possible through meditation. This is a direct antidote, if you like, to always being drawn out into the world and therefore being so vulnerable, being so dependent, so susceptible to losing the balance of our mind because other people and things aren't the way we want them to be. So we have to make this shift from out there to in here. And this is where we need to again put in the effort to understand that our true happiness lies in our own mind, being prepared to make the effort to cultivate the mind in meditation. So again, this is wisdom. All of what I've said so far is pointing towards wisdom, understanding the context in which conflict arises, and understanding the context in which we'll find some way out of conflict, that is, doing the inner work, paying attention to our own experience, and coming back over and over again to that as our focus. In practical terms, once we've become aware of the effect of defilements in the mind, the effect that they have on our own state of well-being, then the willingness to try to work towards the wholesome, seeing the value in cultivating wholesome qualities in the mind, this is the important step which underpins all the rest of the work that we're going to do. Unless we value cultivating wholesomeness, we're not going to be prepared to do the work, which is at times quite difficult. The Buddha said, even to have the desire to cultivate the wholesome, even if we can't do it, that's at least heading in the right direction. So I encourage you to reflect on what I've said, not just in abstract terms, but in terms of the conflicts that you've been involved in recently, the conflicts maybe that you're involved in right now with your intimate enemies or with the people that you work with or live next door to. Reflecting on the things I've said about we all want to survive, we all want to survive well, and we make those who don't serve us at least wrong because they don't serve us. But is that accurate? We're all in this together. Now, when it comes down to the actual practice of trying to deal with these conflicts, the first thing the Buddha said is that we need to try to avoid them. So not only do we have to know when unwholesomeness is present in the mind, because that's going to make us vulnerable to getting into conflict, we also have to know what supports it arising. What are the conditions that bring it about? Because in the Buddha's teaching, nothing arises independently. Nothing exists independently of a variety of causes and conditions. So, for example, if you think about how you wake up in the morning, if that's your grumpy time of day and everyone knows to steer clear of you, well, the fact that you are maybe not getting enough sleep, or that you're not eating enough good food, or the fact that you are working until late at night and not allowing the mind to calm down sufficiently so that you get a good rest. These can be the sort of factors that contribute to waking up grumpy and then being on bad terms with everyone right from the start of the day. So this is what we have to investigate in our own experience. What are the things that contribute to my vulnerability? It may be at work, dealing with a particular person, and you know that this particular person always makes you feel irritated or makes you feel as though you're going to get into trouble. So you always get tense when they're around. So then you start to observe, well, what actually contributes to that result of me feeling nervous and anxious? That nervousness and anxiousness is my personal particular response to that person. Not everyone's going to have that same reaction. So what's happening in my life? What's contributing to my reaction? What things can I change? What things can't I change? So you have to take this into your own life and investigate for yourself. Once you investigate, you'll see some of the things that are contributing to this situation, to this animosity, to this conflict, are things that you can do something about. You can make sure that you meet them under certain conditions, that you don't speak to them when other people are around, for example, that you make sure that you don't speak to them at the end of the day when they want to get away quickly. All of these things can contribute to the conflict that we experience in our life. And so being aware of when it's present and then being aware of what brings it into being, what allows it to continue, and also what helps it to pass away, what brings it to cessation. These are things we need to discover for ourselves. We also need to be able to refrain from acting in the ways that we know are going to bring us into conflict with people. And here speech is very important. Right use of speech, the Buddha emphasized many, many times. And he said that even if you know that something is true about a person or about a situation, if it's unbeneficial to helping to get things done or to get on with each other, then you should try not to say it. So even if it's true, sometimes we have to hold our tongue, not say it. And if it's true and if it's beneficial in the relationship, in the situation, then find the right time before you say it. Now, the right time is when we are free of ill will, not when we want to make a point, teach them a lesson, point out their bad faults. Sometimes we can fool ourselves. Sometimes we think this is for their own good, that's why I'm saying it. So we have to come back to our own state of mind. How do I feel while I'm saying this? Is my heart really full of loving kindness, a wish for their ease as well as my own? And another thing the Buddha said is when we speak, we should speak unhurriedly. So in a situation where we've got time to talk, and also as we talk, not to speak very quickly, rushing over things. And this is actually a very good guideline for us to follow, to see how we're actually feeling in our own heart. Because it's very hard to speak unhurriedly when we're feeling very irritated and agitated with someone. So if we can't say it in a cool way, then that's a good indication that it's not the right time. Even if it's true, even if it's beneficial, find the right time. If it's untrue, if it's unbeneficial, then on no account should we utter it. So again, this comes back to our own experience. Watching over our own thought and our own speech and then our own action. And if we have any doubt about where we're really coming from, then we can tune into our physical experience of the situation. If there's any unpleasantness in our physical experience, any of the gut-wrenching, the heart-pounding, all of that kind of thing, that's a good indication that there's defilement present in the mind, some sort of ill will, some sort of aversion, some sort of wanting for myself. This self-assertion is at the heart of all of these conflicts that we find ourselves in. Just remembering that we're on the bus and now everyone who's got a seat is taking it away from me. And so that's the starting point. So we tune in, we know what helps us and what doesn't. We try to avoid, and then we try to restrain ourselves. And then the next thing we can do is to cultivate the opposites of these feelings of anger and ill will, trying to cultivate those qualities in our life which are going to help us to deal skillfully with conflicts when they arise. My own life is the contemplation on compassion. And this is based on the fact, again, of understanding that we're all in the same boat. All of us are born again because of our ignorance and our craving. But all of us want to be happy. None of us wants to suffer. And really, we don't want to cause suffering for other people either. But because of our ignorance and because of our desires, here we go again, often finding ourselves in the middle of another difficult situation because of our ignorance, because of our craving. And so at that time, that's an opportunity to allow compassion to arise. First of all, compassion for ourselves. Here I am again in the middle of suffering. Didn't want it, and here I am. Ignorance and craving brought me to this place once more. And so we can lighten up a bit. We can even laugh at ourselves. The joke's on me. And then we can understand that the other person that we're dealing with, the one we think's the problem, they're also suffering from their own ignorance and craving. And the joke's on them as well. And if we can just reflect in this way with a little bit of humour, we think we're so great, so many years of practice maybe, so many years of this or that, and here we are in the middle of it again. And so allowing this compassion to arise, that we want to be free of suffering. I want to be free of suffering. They want to be free of suffering. May we both be free of suffering. How can we tackle this so that we're both free of suffering? And this is one of the things that we can use when we're in the middle of something, just to really shift from that heavy idea of I've got to win to how can we get out of this without causing more pain for ourselves and the other person. Many of these things you need to develop and cultivate before you're in the middle of a crisis. And afterwards, very often, we carry the scars of the conflicts that we've been in and we want to get revenge. We think that we've got to pay this person back for whatever they've done to us. And once more, the Buddha said, well, reflect, who's going to suffer even if you get your revenge? Just the presence of ill will, of aversion, of anger in the mind is unpleasant, unhealthy, is not for our own good. So that's the first reflection that we do. Another way we can reflect is to reflect on the fact that this person that I think is so terrible probably has some good points as well. Even though we see them as all dark and as all wrong, they certainly have some good qualities too. Maybe not to us, maybe we've never received anything good from them, but we can look and see that there are some good qualities about them. Even the person that we don't like at work, or maybe at least the fact that they're always there every day, that's something that they contribute to the smooth running of the place. We need sometimes to look pretty hard to find these things, but everyone has good points to them that we need to reflect on, not for their benefit, but for our own. If we only dwell on the negativity, then we're suffering. The Buddha said we can also reflect that this person has a mother and a father, just like we do, and their mother and father probably love them and think they're great, even though we think they're a pain. And so again, we sit them in a different light and also start to change the quality or the colour of our own mind so that we're not dwelling in just the negative aspects. Another way we can reflect is when we're very angry with someone. One of the contemplations that we do is that each one of us consists of 32 parts that comprise this body, starting with the hair of the head, the hair of the body, the nails, teeth and skin, and then going inside to reflect on the fact that this body is made up of the kidneys and the lungs and the heart and all of those things which we don't like to think of as me, but which actually comprise this body. This body, when it's whole, we like to identify with as this is who I am very often, especially if we like the way our body looks or what it can do. But all of us have all these various parts. And so when we're angry with someone, we can reflect, well, which part of them am I angry with? Am I angry with the hair of their head or the teeth or their kidney or the nails? And again, this is just a way of helping us to lighten up, to move our focus from the blackness to the negative, from the negativity to something which helps us to get things in perspective. When we look for that thing that we can absolutely blame as the cause of our problems, we see we can't find it. It's like quicksilver. We can't grab it. And the next reflection we can do is that each one of us is the owner of our own karma. As I said before, when we plant seeds of harm, then we reap fruits of harm towards ourselves. So if someone has hurt us, if someone's done us wrong, then we don't have to be the executioner. Their own karma will serve them to receive the fruits of what they've done. We may not be around to see it, we may not even know it, but we can ensure that this universal law of cause and effect will eventually play itself out in their life. And so this takes off this burden of the fact that we have to show them, we have to teach them, we have to give them their just deserts. We can absolve ourselves of that responsibility and make our mind lighter. And last of all, the Buddha said that if you can't use any of those things, what you have to do is just know that to dwell in thoughts of revenge, hatred, ill will are harmful to yourself, and don't allow the mind to dwell on them. Don't pay attention to that which is going to cause you to suffer. So these are the kinds of reflections that we need to cultivate. And none of the things that I've talked about is going to be an overnight solution to any of the difficult relationships that we find ourselves involved in. These are all things that need to be cultivated before, during and after we find ourselves in any conflict. Now, like my friend who found herself in conflict with the salesperson, sometimes you don't go out looking for trouble, but there it is in front of you. And so all of these contemplations can be brought to bear at that time to get things in perspective. Maybe this person's having a hard day. Maybe they've got lots of conflict in their life. Maybe they've got bad news. Maybe they've had difficulties at work. All sorts of reasons why they're in a bad way. And if nothing else, just reflecting on the fact that, like me, they're on the bus, they want to survive, and they're trying to do it as sweetly as possible. And like me, they think they're the most important person on the bus. And that's why there's conflict. If we find ourselves in conflict with those who are closest to us, then we need to bring these teachings to bear, because we need to understand that the long-term consequences are going to affect all of us. We can't find a solution to the conflict that we're in that doesn't include a positive or a helpful outcome for everyone. No one is going to win at the expense of others without having to pay a price. So especially in our social relationships, we need to be very sensitive to this fact. And also we have to be sensitive to the fact that we can't expect to do our spiritual practice, do our meditation, enjoy blissful states, if we don't clean up our social relationships as well. if we don't carry our spiritual practice into our relationships and our daily life, then we're not going to be able to make progress. And in fact, the quality of our relationships with other people should reflect the practice that we're doing in our spiritual work. So there's no separation in this sense between the inner and the outer. But for our own benefit, we need to cultivate wholesome qualities which will bring us peace and harmony within ourselves and allow us to live in peace and harmony with others. So I offer these words for you tonight and hope that they are useful for you. And if you have any questions or any comments, then please feel free to make them. Yes, if you're enlightened. The question was, is it possible once you leave one vehicle not to get into the next bus? And that's what we're aiming for. We're aiming not to be reborn. But when you have no craving to get into the next bus, then you're not propelled to take the next bus. But you have to have already arrived at that state when you're leaving the other vehicle. Well, when there's no fuel, then this entity which we think of as me, this mind and body, has no fuel to propel it further on. Well, there is no self. That's one of the difficult aspects of the Buddha's teaching to understand, that what we assume to be this self, this mind and body, once we actually investigate it very closely, we find is a series of interactions and processes between mind and body, cause and effect. And as we think of things as having a solid core to them, but when we investigate both this mind and this body, we find that it's like peeling an onion. We go, we take layer upon layer off as we peel the onion, and we discover that when we get to the last layer, there's nothing there. Craving is what binds the layers together. So when the craving is no longer there, then the layers are no longer bound together, and that's when there's no rebirth. That's not a simple thing to understand. We have to practice. That's why we have to practice even to experience. For example, we can experience non-self when we contemplate how our anger arises and how we get into conflict. Sometimes we can think of ourselves as just an angry person. So when we start to see, well, what contributed, what gave rise to this particular incidence of anger and conflict, we see that there are always causes and conditions that give rise to it. Some of them may be within ourselves. Maybe we're not feeling well that day. Maybe we're feeling sad, or maybe we've had an argument before we arrived at the office, and that makes us more susceptible to have another argument once we get there. But when we take all these causes and conditions and look at them and sift through them, we see that there's no being there who is angry. Anger has just arisen because the conditions have been right for it. And so then we see, well, there's no angry person there. There is just anger that found a resting place at this time in this mind and body. Yes? Why was he born? Well, he needed to be reborn until he became enlightened. It was only after he became enlightened that he wasn't reborn. So up until his last birth, he still had the craving to be. And sorry? Incomplete in the sense that he had greed, hatred and delusion still. And so it's when greed, hatred and delusion are no longer present that one becomes enlightened. So it's in fact not that wisdom was missing, but he had greed, hatred and delusion, and that's what needs to drop away in order to be enlightened. Yes? How can Right. The question is about how to deal with someone who is harming you and you're not responding with anger, but they are continuing to harm you. And so this is something that is based on wisdom as well as compassion, because the Buddhist teaching isn't about just standing there and letting someone hit you over the head again and again and again. The teaching is not to retaliate in like manner, but this is where you have to use wisdom. Sometimes if you've understood that this person is only acting in this way because they themselves have tremendous suffering, because someone can't continually hurt other beings without having tremendous pain in their own mind. A person who's happy, a person who's fulfilled, doesn't seek to harm other people. It's someone who isn't feeling happy and isn't feeling fulfilled who acts in that way. So you generate as much compassion as you can for that person, and then you have to find skillful ways in which to protect yourself. So you may need to avoid their company, you may need to put an end to the friendship, you may need to put a limit on what you will allow or take from them. You have to be aware of your own motivation in maintaining a relationship with them. If it's someone that you can't avoid, say someone that you're working with, then you have to leave whatever they have with them, like their own ill will. Recognise that it's in their own mind, in their own heart, and it's not something that you have to take on board. So in order to be sufficiently strong not to do that, you have to cultivate the inner strength that comes through living a good life, being a person of integrity yourself, keeping the precepts, living a moral life, cultivating the mind in meditation so that you have an inner peace which isn't dependent on the outside world and what you get from the outside world. That gives you an inner confidence to know that you're living a good life, that you don't have to be swayed by whatever they might say about you, whatever judgments that they might make about you. And as you develop with this the morality, the integrity, the developing the strong mind, having the inner confidence, then it becomes clearer and clearer how to deal with this particular person. Very often we're looking for a one-off solution or a blanket to answer, but we have to actually gain the wisdom in the situation itself. What is appropriate, what is skillful to do with this particular person right now? So if there are no more questions, I'll ask James to come up and make the announcements.